get your news on with Ron. Don't you want to know what's going on? We're getting our news on today. Get your news on with Ron. Don't you want to know what's going on? We're getting our news on today. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You can tweet me an article at Ron Placone. We'll go through it together and make it our own. Get your news on with Ron. Don't you want to know what's going on? Getting our news on today, yeah, 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 yeah. Welcome to Get Your News On with Ron, the podcast. What's up, everybody? Happy Labor Day, question mark. Are we really, we kind of just celebrate all these things very ironically these days. Everything should have an asterisk right now. In the United States. Hey, happy Labor Day. By the way, no more unemployment benefits during a pandemic. We'll get into that. But anyway, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. And to everyone listening to the podcast later, hope all's well. Maybe you're having a picnic. Maybe you're chilling out. That's cool. Happy Labor Day. Shout out to everyone who makes this so possible, our friends over at Indie Left. Indie Left is a place to find all the content creators and streamers you know and love. They curate a list. They update it twice a day to find everything they got going on and to subscribe to their Discord community. Go to independentleft.media. That's their link tree. All right. Without further ado, I am ringing in the Labor Day with a labor musician. And what better way to celebrate Labor Day than a comedian and a musician just talking about the world? You guys know him. He's a friend of the show. He's been on a few times, and he's going to be playing for us later, so I can't wait. Please welcome back to the show, Mr. David Robix. What's up, David?
Thank you, Ron. It is great to be with you again. And I can't believe I hadn't thought of that. Why did they actually – The unemployment benefits actually expire actually like the day after Labor Day this week. I mean, what kind of timing was that? Intentional?
That right.
I just never thought of that, because for me, Labor Day is May Day, and I never think about Labor Day's existence except when the holiday comes up, you know. But once I was asked to sing at a Labor Day picnic, I think. That was my experience with the labor movement on Labor Day, as far as I can recall.
Only one time in your entire career you were asked to do a Labor Day thing?
Yeah, it's really quite something. I do a lot of stuff with the labor movement in Europe and even other countries as well. But in the United States, no. I mean, I know. Yeah, it's really quite something. Literally, it was once. Although, I mean, I've played for labor unions other times. For a few years, it was like I always had just enough union gigs that it was worth actually covering the union dues for being in the musicians union.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it's been years since I've been paid in terms of gigs for the labor movement anything more than the dues for being in the union. Well, not that these things are comparable in some sense, but it's just like, you know, in terms of any financial worthwhileness of, you know, being in the union,
sure.
There absolutely is none. It's sad.
Well, I got a couple headlines for us, but since this came up organically, how would you describe the differences between the labor movements in the United States versus in other parts of the world? Are there areas where they're stronger than others? Like, what's your experience been, you know, throughout the course of a pretty, I mean, long career in that movement? I mean, you've been active in that scene for, what, over 20 years at this point, right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I would say, you know, my first response is probably something that would be flip and really not useful. But I mean, because really, I mean, some of the best organizers I've ever met are union organizers in the United States. And that I will preface anything I say with that statement.
Okay.
Having said that, the labor bureaucracy in this country is a complete disaster. And the labor movement in this country has been a disaster since about 1948, when they kicked out the left from the AFL-CIO. But, I mean,
well, what happened
never recovered from
that.
There was, it was at the, well, I mean, basically the Red Scare has been going on ever since, like, really, really long before the Russian Revolution. But with the Russian Revolution in 1917, ever since then, there's been massive amounts of propaganda in the United States against, you know, communism, Bolshevism, socialism, etc. And in a nutshell, the backbone of the American labor movement in the 19-teens was anarcho-syndicalists, represented by the industrial workers of the world. And the backbone of the American labor movement in the 1930s was communists and socialists. And when they kicked out, when the American Federation of Labor joined with the Congress of Industrial Organizations and the AFL-CIO was formed, it was formed basically on the condition that the CIO got rid of its best organizers. And that's what they did. Mm-hmm. And so it's been, and then also in, I believe it was the year before that, now we're stressing my memory of laws, but I believe it was the year before that the Taft-Hartley Act was passed, and that was a terribly destructive law that other countries have also had to deal with. But in this country, it is illegal to strike in solidarity with another union. So basically, the basic principles of industrial unionism are impossible to implement legally in the United States. You can't organize as a class or organize as an industry. That's illegal. You can only organize within different companies, and you can refuse to cross a picket line. That's legal, but you can't actually like strike in solidarity with another other workers who are striking in another related industry to yours just because you want to take on the bosses. You know, that's illegal. They can destroy your union for that. They can bankrupt your union, and you know, if you try to do that. Which is why in Sweden they have a saying, long live the illegal strikes, because they tried to pass the same law in Sweden, but the unions just rebelled.
Yeah, they're not messing around there. They don't mess around in Sweden. They don't mess around in Sweden. They don't mess around in France. They don't mess around in Germany. They don't mess around there.
And you can see the results, you know. I mean, it's also like they also have better circumstances to be not messed with, you know, in terms of parliamentary democracy and stuff, you know. But
And their job is not tied to their health care and things like that. So there's many reasons. Like I don't, you know, when you look at what they do over there, it's hard to be like, why don't we have this? But well, there's a lot of systemic reasons why we don't have this, and it's by design. Yeah. Well, the good news here is that I do have a little bit of good news. It's on a micro level, but I got a couple headlines for you. And one of them you probably already know about, and I'm looking forward to talking to you about it. And it is a little bit of, bittersweet, nice news. So we do have a little bit of that. But first, we'll go with what I teased in the intro here. So federal pandemic unemployment benefits expire nationwide. Happy Labor Day. For the first time in the year and a half since the pandemic began, there are no more federal pandemic unemployment benefits. About half the states already pulled out to try to get people back to work, but now they've expired nationwide. That means no more unemployment benefits for gig workers and the self-employed, no more extra $300 a week, no more extended benefits for people who've been unemployed for a long time. And folks, I don't know if you noticed, the pandemic, definitely not over. And they did it on Labor Day. Like how... I think if you had any doubt whatsoever, which if you watch this show, you probably don't have any of that doubt. By the way, guys, side note here, for anyone who's keeping score at home, Lucy is feeling better, which I am so thrilled about.
The cat.
Yeah, yes, how much better is she feeling?
I did see a tweet about Lucy, and I was wondering myself.
Oh, she's feeling a lot better, David, and that's why she's jumping up on the desk a bunch. She's back to her old self where she jumps up on the desk on the regular during the show, and I would have it no other way. I would have it no other way. Hey, sweetie. Yeah, she's got a lot of her energy back, and it's good. She's pretty much back to her old self, which makes me so freaking happy. But anyway, if there was any doubt that our government was anything more than a corporate coup, this should just dispel any of that doubt. Like, on Labor Day, they're taking away unemployment benefits during a pandemic where they never did what we needed to do during a pandemic, never paid people to stay home. They're still not going to. It's not going to happen. And now the crumbs of crumbs that they threw to people while simultaneously having an obscene upward transfer of wealth to Wall Street, they're taking that away. Well, the pandemic is still raging and people are still desperate, and it's supposed to be a freaking Labor Day. Now, keep in mind, the last time, and you kind of teased this at the beginning too, the last time labor was organized just enough, and I'm not saying they got along all the time. They didn't. They had their disagreements. We know this. But the last time the unions and the socialists and the communists and the anarchists really got together, a New Deal happened. Social Security happened. A weekend happened. Living wage, well, minimum wage happened. Child labor laws happened. That was the last
taxation,
time.
Even up until Eisenhower, progressive taxation was 91%. The top tax rate for the highest income earners was 91%.
And that's been gutted ever since, man.
Yeah.
That's been gutted ever since. Do you think there's any way out of this thing other than a general strike?
I mean, I think the only way out of this thing is going to be a really massive, really well-organized social movement that rises above all of these different divisions and unites the entire working class, which is the kind of social movement that actually makes a difference historically in this country. And that's the kind of social movement that, contrary to many different popular opinions, was actually being built in this country in the late 1960s. It's the kind of social movement that existed in this country in the 1930s and in prior to the 1930s as well. And it's the kind of social movement that actually, you know, makes a difference. And, you know, a bunch of special interests standing up for their own little special interests tends not to build the kind of social movements that we need, and I think often tends to create just the opposite kind of effect.
Well, there's got to be some action, though, right? I mean, like, and that's why, like, I think the only action is a general strike. We need to just shut it down completely. And until
A general strike, society-wide, whatever that looks like. I just hesitate to use the term general strike because I'm not sure exactly what that looks like in the gig economy. You know, I mean, because we're not, we do not have that kind of industrial economy where all the factory workers just stop working, right? But we do have industries, of course, where everybody, you know, where there are lots of people employed in the industry, and we can have those kinds of general strikes. But I mean, these things need to be, yeah, well thought out. I mean, for one thing, generally involve a system of actually trans. Like, if all the people involved with transportation are going on strike, you know, that'll quickly become a problem for a lot of people unless they have a whole plan for how the essential items get delivered, which was part of the deal in past general strikes, like in Seattle, and you know. So, I mean, it's very complicated, but we need a movement, and it needs to be really well organized and really national. But also it needs to be in every town and city in the country, you know. And,
oh, totally.
It's not going to just happen, but we sure need that kind of movement.
No, I'm with you. And yeah, I mean, when I say general strike, I'm not implying that it's going to be easy. And I don't think it's not quite as black and white as nobody is doing anything. In fact, there's a lot of people who will be doing more because we need massive amounts of mutual aid. We need massive amounts of organization. We need people that are kind of outside of, you know, like outside of the traditional work economy or whatever you want to call it. People like us, creatives like us, you know, we got to help out. We got to pick up some slack. We got to be communication vehicles or places for people go, you know. I mean, so, you know, so it's not like it literally means that no one is doing anything. It just means we shut down the essential things that are really going to make the oligarchs feel it in their pocketbooks. And we have a support system so that we can safely do that for the people. And the oligarchs and the Jeff Bezos of the world, who are really the people calling the shots, they go to the politicians who they have on their puppet strings and they say, we just lost some money. We just give them what they want because we want our money. Give them what they want.
When they're worried, they react, you know. I mean, yeah. When they're worried, they react. I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean they'll give you things. They might react in all kinds of other ways. But I think it's always going to be some combination of concessions, repression, and distraction. And those are the three basic principles, I think, that they operate by. And I'm just seeing so much of all of that going on right now. And I mean, with the anniversary of 9/11 coming up, I've just written an essay, and so I've been in this headspace thinking about the past century of different social movements, including the one that we've been experiencing over the past couple of years, especially 2020, but also the global justice movement of 21, 22 years ago, as well as other movements past, and it always seems like there's some kind of consistent reactions on the part of the ruling class. It's some combination of concession, repression, and distraction. And I think we've gotten a lot of all three in the past couple of years. And certainly the pandemic unemployment was part of that. I mean, they threw more money at us than they've thrown at the working class in a very long time. It's not that we all caught it, you know, because their system for distributing the money is completely, you know, totally incompetent. And I mean, here in Oregon, we're working with software that was written in the 1980s. I mean, it's just stunning how the level of incompetence.
I think a lot of that was by design. I think incompetence was a little bit of it, sure, but I think a lot of it, like take the PPP loans, for example. When you're going to have first come, first serve, dog eat dog, which is, hey, that's the American way, and you designate, quote, small business can equal something like Steak Shack or whatever, like all these, quote, small businesses, who's going to get that money first? The organization that has a team of lawyers working around the clock ready to just hit submit on their application when the clock strikes midnight, or the people who are in a real small business, the people who it's like, gee, they have a team of lawyers. We're like a 5-person mom and pop operation. We're worried about our kids who can't go to school right now. We're worried about our family members who work for us. We're a real small business who really should be getting these loans, and we ain't going to get jack, or we're going to get a few crumbs.
Yeah.
And friendly reminder before we get off this topic too, since we're on the topic of everything that's going on with pandemic unemployment and all these things our government could be doing, Joe Biden can cancel your student loan debt. We did an entire MMT episode about it, but we're going to keep harping on this. The president, this is from The Nation. The president has broad authority to cancel federal student loan debt through the Higher Education Act. This was passed by Congress in 1965. The act states that the Secretary of Education may enforce, pay, compromise, waive, or release any right, title, claim, lien, or demand, however required, including any equity or any right of redemption. Legal experts, including those at Harvard Law, pretty good school I've heard, say that this provision would allow for an executive action that cancels federal student debt, and the precedent has already been set. So yes, they can cancel your student debt. Yes, they can support people during a pandemic. Yes, they can do all these things. They straight up choose not to. And they're rubbing your face in it because they're taking unemployment away during a pandemic on frickin' Labor Day, a day that's supposed to celebrate the working class. It's a slap in the face, a really bad one.
And I mean, I think what compelled them to actually be as generous as they were for a time with the benefits was the social movement that was in the streets. And I mean, although they would never say that, and it wasn't like a movement that was necessarily focused on getting better benefits for the unemployed, you know. But I think it had that impact, you know, to a huge extent. Hard to say.
Yeah, no. I hear you. I mean, yeah, if it wasn't for the uprising that we did have, we probably wouldn't get what crumbs they threw to us.
They were worried. I think that's why they were throwing crumbs, because normally they're not concerned with the fact that 1 in 8 people, households in this country, gets evicted every year. You know, I mean, normally 1 in 5 children goes to bed hungry every night. They're not normally concerned about that. And things have been getting worse for a very long time under both Democratic and Republican leadership. So if they were concerned about those things, they would have done stuff about it a long time ago, you know, rather than just making everything worse with each, new administration. But that has changed, you know, and it didn't change under Biden. It started to change under Trump, and it changed under the Republican-dominated Congress because they were intelligent enough to recognize that in order to maintain domestic tranquility, you needed the people to eat a little better.
Well, and I think like the big theme too, at least like a theme that I have here, is that a politician only does something good when they're scared of losing their job.
And it's a politician in a country that has like, you know, a real democracy where people get elected because, you know, people love them and think that they're going to stand up for their rights really well. And it's important to remember that these countries do exist it doesn't have to be like this.
No shit. I mean, like, that's the biggest. Do you ever just wake up in the morning and say that? Like I wake up in the, like, I will be reading the news, like, in the morning, and I'll just be like, and I'll just be scoffing at everything, just angry. And my wife always asks, what's up? Even though she knows she's not going to like the answer I give her 100% of the time. She still asks.
She loves you, and so she asks.
She loves me.
She knows you need to talk about it.
Yes. Yeah. She's a damn good wife. She still asks anyway. But she braces herself. She's like, what are you reading? What are you reading?
Twitter feed. it's not directly answering your Twitter feed, but it's like,
yeah,
might as
well. She's like, what are you reading? I know you're going to vent right now and you need someone to vent to. And I'm just like, well, here's what I'm reading. And then I go on and on and on. But usually I will say, literally, I'll be like, it doesn't have to be this way. It doesn't have to be this way. It doesn't have to be this shitty. We can do so much better.
And it sounds like such an elitist thing to say, and maybe it is, but I feel bad for the vast majority of the population that can't afford to leave this country because, people have no idea. It can be different, but people have no idea that it is different in other places. It is now different. It doesn't need to be this way, and this is not theoretical. I just did a tour in a country that has no more problem with the virus.
Yeah, yeah. Well, hold on. I want to talk about
I know you were going to talk about that, but that's just like, there's a lot of other things that Denmark doesn't have issues with that we do. There's a lot of other countries too that don't have don't share the same issues we have. We have a lot of kind of unique problems that are unique to our disastrous experiment in whatever this is, democracy, plutocracy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I want to talk about the tour in just a second, but first I got to do my feel good, bittersweet. I feel weird calling it a feel good, but it's a bittersweet story that I really want to share with you. This is my second headline for you today. You knew Anne Feeney, right?
Yeah, very well.
You knew her and you were friends with her and you probably know. Do you know Evan Greer? Do you know Evan? She's awesome.
I've known Evan since Evan was 15, I think.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So Evan Greer, she published this today. Now, even though I'm from the same town as Anne Feeney, I never got to meet her. I knew who she was, but I never got to meet her. But here's a little bit of a bittersweet, feel-good story for today. Anne Feeney, for anyone not in the know, was a folk singer who we lost last year from COVID complications. And here's something that's kind of nice here. Anne Feeney Hellraiser Memorial Fund announces first round of artist grants. This is from Evan Greer, also friend of the show. She's been on the show a bunch of times. I've collaborated with her on a couple campaigns with Fight for the Future, and her music's awesome. The Anne Feeney Hellraiser Fund, established to honor the memory and carry forward the legacy of renowned labor singer Anne Feeney, has announced his first two grant recipients, Mecca Russell, a.k.a. Neffy, a 24-year-old independent folk musician and composer based in Arlington, Virginia, and Mickey O'Brien, who is a rapper and union mine worker, USW 6500, currently on strike in Sudbury, Ontario, Canada. Good luck with the strike, Mickey. That's awesome. So Mecca Russell out of Arlington, Virginia, and Mickey O'Brien out of Sudbury, Ontario, Canada, are the first recipients of the Hellraiser Fund, the grants in honor of Anne Feeney. Each of the two finalists will receive a grant of $1,000 from the Labor Heritage Foundation, who are fiscally sponsoring the Anne Feeney Memorial Fund. The fund was established by close friends and family in July 2021 after Anne Feeney passed away from complications due to COVID-19. It seeks to carry on Anne's work of fostering and encouraging emerging artists who are using their work to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. That's nice.
Yeah. It's wonderful. Yeah.
Did you tour with her ever?
Many times. And so did Evan. And as you know, probably. And also Evan's latest album is fantastic. Was it what is it? The name of the album?
She, her, they, them, I believe.
I think that's
correct. She's had something since then, I believe.
Oh, maybe there's track.
She's had something since then. Yeah. She's been recording a lot. Like she's at least had, like some singles since then, and I think she's actually had another full length since then. So yeah, she's been pretty active, and I guess I occasionally do a music show for an online radio network, and the last one I did, I featured her song Emma Goldman Would Have Beat Your Ass.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard that? That's a fun song.
Yep.
That's a really fun song.
She sang it for Anne and a bunch of other people during on one of Anne's pandemic birthday celebrations on Zoom. And that's and after Anne died, I wrote a song as well, which is on my latest album, May Day, about Anne, called I Dreamed I Saw Anne Feeney.
Yeah.
But, yeah, me and Anne had some great tours together. And also, Anne's husband, you know, is Swedish, and I also spend a lot of time on that part of the Atlantic. And so we spent a lot of time together on both sides of the Atlantic, you know, oddly enough, which is just kind of an accident of our lives having to happening to intersect in that particular way, where we really both spent a lot of time in both Scandinavia and the United States. But yeah.
Yeah. Cause she went all around the world, like pretty much up until the end, right?
I mean, she's done a lot of traveling, but her main network in terms of playing gigs was the U.S., Canada, Sweden, and Ireland, and to some extent Denmark. I mean, she didn't tour much anywhere else, but she traveled to other places. Her son was living in various Latin American countries and Africa, and I believe she's visited them in several different African and Latin American countries. So, I mean, she's done a lot of traveling, but as a touring performer, she's mainly been involved with networks within, you know, certain countries, primarily the United States and Sweden.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, rest in power, Anne Feeney, and I'm glad to see this has been established in her name, and they've already had the first two recipients, and I look forward to checking out both of their music. And again, for everyone at home, Mecca Russell and Mickey O'Brien, check them out. The first recipients of the Hellraiser Fund grants in honor of Anne Feeney. So, David, let's talk touring a little bit. I was hoping
you had a tour booked that isn't happening, is it?
Yeah, we were going to do 3 weeks in October, myself and Graham Elwood, the comic I tour with. And we just decided with the Delta variant on the rise and with the numbers going up and with, you know, the state of the world, it was just too much for right now. Because we were going to a different city pretty much every night. So we're like, well, if something happens, then, you know, we could have been in three or four other cities before we even knew, you know, like if there was a COVID case or something like that, or if one of us were to get it, you know, I mean, we both got the shots, but there, you know, breakthroughs happened. So yeah, we decided against that. We're still keeping some of our California shows. Like, we're still doing some like regional one-off-y type stuff. But that, you know, all the national, you know, outside of California stuff, we've canceled. So it sucks. But you know, I didn't think I thought we'd be further than this by now. But you bet on a different horse, so to speak. And I think you bet on the right one, and I really didn't, because you just had a fun old tour in Denmark.
I did, and it's also, I mean, oddly enough, with the campaign to cancel me and with the situation with the pandemic and touring and the Delta variant and all that stuff, the last time I did a tour in the United States was at least 5 years ago. And that's for financial reasons, because this country sucks to tour in. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons why it has become a shitty country to try to do gigs in, but it sucks. And other people may feel differently if they have a really much larger following than I do. And I know some people in that situation, and for them, touring the United States is still good. But for anybody that doesn't get more than, you know, doesn't get like at least 100, 200 people consistently showing up to all your gigs and paying a good cover, then there's no way to make touring this country work, because there's just so much overhead involved. And so I have for many years been primarily touring in Europe.
Well, how is it different over there for anyone who, you know, might not be in the know as far as like what it means to be a creative professional? Like, how is it different over there?
I mean, for one thing, I mean, the pandemic thing is a whole other question, but leaving that out of it, just in general, in touring in Europe, arts funding, there's 100 to 1 arts funding in Europe compared to the United States. And that statistic is very misleading because most of the arts funding in the United States goes to, guess where? The military. The military bans 60% of arts funding in the United States. So the 100 to 1 statistic is very misleading. So actually, it's much worse than that, right? And so what that means in reality is that when you're – and that's just only the tip of the iceberg. The fact that there's 100 times as much arts funding in Europe is only the tip of the iceberg. But what that means is that you will be playing in a punk rock club in some random town in Denmark or Germany and – Sweden, wherever, Norway, whatever, any number of other countries. And it will be funded by the cultural ministry. And that kind of thing varies from country to country, how much they fund punk rock as opposed to opera. But the arts funding is huge and generally. And that plays out in all kinds of different ways. But then other things that happen, it's like, at least in my circle of music, which is admittedly not like the mainstream, but like for what I'm doing, most people in most European countries are in a union. And, you know, maybe that's not quite true anymore with the gig economy. It might be less than half in some countries now, but it's huge. I mean, most of Europe is more unionized than we've ever been.
Yeah, because we're at about 10% right now.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't count the public sector, I think we're down to like 5%. Mm-hmm. And in Europe, I mean, it's like, I mean, then the most we've ever been is like 35%, I think, in the U.S. in the 60s, and you know, that's very low for Europe. I mean, you know, even today, that would be a very low number of union members. But, I mean, so what that means in terms of unions is that every town has a union building, you know, buildings owned by the unions, they have theaters in them, they have budgets, they put on events. Not only that, but all these countries we're talking about, especially outside of England, but all these other countries, they're multi-party democracies, and there are left parties that are actually left parties, so that if you're a musician playing leftist kind of music, you have a natural ally, not only in the labor movement, which has oftentimes an awareness of the importance of culture and actually owns and puts on events in theaters that they have in every town, but you know, you have political parties that want to build their parties and they want to use music as part of that process. They put on summer camps and festivals, and they have all kinds of other events to foster a sense of community and build up the support for their parties. And so in places like Denmark, the third biggest party in the country is what is known as the Unity List, which is a coalition of all the Marxist and other left and environmental parties that existed basically in the early 90s, who all came together to form one party. They're now the third biggest party in the country. And I sing at their events all over the country. And I know members of parliament who are in the party and city
country being
mayors
Denmark.
And is in Denmark. Yeah, all over Denmark. And then, you know, people vote for these people because they love them, because, you know, not in every case, but, you know, in many cases, because they know that these are people that have been serving the interests of the working class in Denmark for their whole lives. You know, sometimes they're quite young, so that may be like, you know, very theoretical. But in other cases, like the MP, Member of Parliament, Christian Juhl, I mean, I don't know how old he is, maybe 70 by now, but I've known him at least 20 years, and since he was a union official, and now, you know, he's a member of parliament, and I mean, he works his ass off, but I mean, you know, he's doing great stuff. It's a whole different reality in a lot of other countries. And this is despite the fact that the ruling party is, you know, by many, you know, in many ways, not very good. I mean, you know, the Social Democrats in Denmark, you know, there's a lot to criticize about them, you know, a whole sure. lot, you know, but, you know, still, even
well, but
so.
The difference is, and my buddy, I have a buddy who's Swedish, and we were just talking about this recently. He's like, dude, like, yeah, we have some neoliberalism just like you have in the United States. It's not like it doesn't exist, but the bad is not near as bad, and the good is way better. And a big reason for that is like, they have to listen to the socialists. They have to listen to the communists. They can't ignore them, because it's not this like corporate coup duopoly. It's a better democratic system. So they have to listen to these people, and they have to meet them.
I mean, and Sweden is a good example in terms of recent events in Sweden. I mean, the left party in Sweden, which is it's just called the left party, and they were not part of the ruling like coalition or whatever, but they were their participation in this coalition was necessary in order for the. I guess they were part of the coalition. They didn't have real political power, but their vote was needed for the Social Democrats to stay in power.
Right.
And basically, the Social Democrats entertained the possibility of ending rent control in some properties in Sweden. And just for talking about it, the left party pulled out of the coalition, which was absolutely a fantastic move, you know, because it just, I mean, because they didn't have real power to really influence policy. They were just, there was just a small party in that case in terms of this coalition, but pulling out of the coalition, it was like throwing their cards on the table, and it just was fantastic. So like, it was a seismic event, and it's going to have an impact on Swedish politics, I think, in terms of you're talking about ending rent control, which is fantastic. I mean, it's just it's such an important issue, and the left party knows it. And so, yeah, they can have, without having, you know, any kind of a majority or something, they can have real power, you know, real influence in multi-party democracies.
So did they drop their idea to potentially end rent control real quick? Did they drop that?
No longer.
So beautiful.
Table. Yeah.
God.
No longer on the table.
What would it take for the United States to be like that?
I mean, we've never had a multi-party democracy, which is, I mean, part of the problem here is when they talk about with such pride that this is the oldest democracy, you know, of in the modern age. Depending on whether you count Iceland and whatever, but basically, by many accounts, in some ways, in important ways, the United States is the oldest, certainly one of the older democracies in the world. Which it's people will often say, "Oh, it's a young country," whatever that means. But it's the age of American settler colonialism goes back 500 years. So in that sense, it's young. But in the sense of having democratic institutions. Since after throwing the British out, you know, we formed this extremely limited form of democracy, which we've been stuck with ever since, and it's only in many ways gotten worse. Mm-hmm. But you know, it was never a multi-party democracy to begin with. So, other democracies in Europe, they formed their houses of parliament and their multi-party democracies and stuff in the sort of burning wreckage of the rebellions of 1848. And I don't know, we didn't have that here. And I mean, we had the rent strike wars in upstate New York in the 1840s, which was kind of like our version of the 1840s in Europe, but it was a much, much smaller scale. I mean, the rent strike wars in the 1840s, they weren't really wars, but that's how they became known. But the rent strike wars in upstate New York in the 1840s, there was a 9-year long rent strike at the home of the richest family in the United States that owned this massive amounts of property up and down the Hudson River, and the tenant farmers refused to pay the rent for 9 years. And the outcome of this movement was the Homestead Act, which gave a lot of land to a lot of people, although it was also very corrupt and racist and very much benefited the railroad industry. And you know, it had a lot of massive problems, but a lot of working class and poor people got free land out of this, which was a giveaway that didn't have to happen, and happened big part of it was to do the whole settler colonial thing and give the poor whites reason to move west. But a big part of it also was they didn't have to do it that way. They could have expanded feudalism to the west the way feudalism was basically running the east. And to a large extent, in many ways, feudal economics rules the whole country, but to the extent that there were to some extent a fair program of basically giving away land or selling it very cheaply to settlers, and to the extent that that's a good thing, and I know it's a very complicated question, we're, you know, all this all when we're talking about the Homestead Act, but you know, just to the extent that that was a positive thing, it was the result of a rebellion. And but Europe had far, far larger rebellions around that same time period, and they gave rise to far better democracies than we have ever had here. And that's just one aspect of why we have a lot. I mean, there's so many other reasons why things are so much more messed up here. I also think the aftermath of World War II was a massive reason why, because, I mean, half of all industrial production in the entire world was in the United States after World War II. So that distorted the whole economy and allowed for a very large sector of the working class to be bought off. And I think we still are suffering from that legacy of this sort of mindless patriotism that pervades so much of the population for different reasons.
Well, because that's also when we really decided we're going to turn it up to 11 as far as we are the world's police. We are an economy of war. It's not like that didn't start with World War II, but that's when we turned it up to 11.
That's when we were the only ones standing, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, That's when, the rest of the participants in World War II were all completely destroyed. I mean, the only country that didn't get totally destroyed was the one, the only thing that happened on U.S. soil, to the extent that it's U.S. soil, was the Navy being wiped out in Pearl Harbor, which was no small thing. I mean, it was all concentrated in one place. You know, it's like pretty convenient to just bomb one third of the Navy all in one place at the same time. But other than that very, militarily ingenious little, or just, I mean, really stupid move on the part of the U.S. military and ingenious on the part of the Japanese Empire. But of course, also, while we're talking about history, people should know that there was a blockade against Japan at the time that the United States Navy was enforcing. And the bombing of Pearl Harbor was a response to that.
Mm-hmm. So, what do you think is going to happen when the moratorium ends? Because that's another thing looming. Next month, the eviction moratorium ends in the United States. It doesn't end in all the states. The one in California is still going. And what about Oregon? Are you guys still okay or what?
I mean, technically, the eviction moratorium nationally ended last month when the Supreme Court said that the CDC's authority was overstepped. They struck it down. They said, we waited and we've given the Congress a chance to pass actual laws. And I mean, as messed up as the Supreme Court is and always has been and especially is now, it's not an unreasonable position. I mean, the Congress actually could be banning evictions permanently as a banning forced evictions as a means of solving problems. I mean, forced evictions are virtually unheard of in many different countries in the so-called, civilized world where people have rights, which does not include this country, because our rights, what's the right to free speech and assembly? In other countries, they have a right to things like housing, but we don't have any of those rights. We just have these rights that look good on paper, but in actual reality, what people really need much more than the right to free speech, which is nice, but what a lot of people would rather have in addition to that is a place to live and, healthcare, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court struck it down, and I guess Congress isn't acting. Yeah. Like they're not.
Congress
doing
isn't doing anything. They're on vacation. Yeah. So now I think there's four states where Oregon, California, New York, I'm guessing the fourth must be Massachusetts. I think they said on NPR recently there were four states where there's a stronger eviction moratorium in place. And, and I know the one in New York goes until the end of the year. I think the one here goes, I can't remember till when now, I should know. But the rest of the country, I think, certainly very big parts of the country, Texas, Georgia, Florida, there's massive amounts of evictions going on right now. Arizona.
What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I mean, for one thing, it'll spread the virus really well. And because, of course, but for another, I mean, I guess I always figure that if there's going to be evictions, ideally they'll come in a wave and so that people can see what's happening. And because it's like the frog in the water, if it's just a slow process, it's easy enough to think like, oh, well, this is happening for that reason or that another reason, but of course, most evictions happen because of people can't afford to pay the rent. You know, that's why they get evicted. You know, the overwhelming majority of cases, it's not for any other reason. And that's just going to become a bigger problem now. But then the question is, how are people going to respond? And I have no idea, because the way people need to respond is through solidarity and mutual aid and a movement of the unemployed, the way we had in the 1930s, where everybody defends everybody else's right to having a place to live and to not being evicted, and like unevict each other and put the locks back on the doors and, you know, take agency and take action and work collectively. And when people did that in the 30s, they banned evictions altogether in one of the biggest cities in the world, in Chicago. But that could happen again. But also, if the ruling class and their minions in National Pentagon Radio and other such entities are successful and continue to be successful in distracting us from the fact that we are one big working class getting systematically screwed by people like Bezos, and have us just fighting with each other, which seems to be a lot of what's going on, then I don't think there's any hope in organizing on that basis. I mean, we're not going to be able to organize an anti-eviction movement if we're all busy shouting at each other about, you know, who's more oppressed than the other while we're all getting evicted. So I'm not at all I'm not hopeful about the political atmosphere in this country. It seems to me completely toxic, both online and offline, from what I see on the streets of Portland and on socials, anti-social media. I just keep on trying to do whatever I can in terms of participating in the debate to the extent that there's a debate. But it's really dismal. And that's another thing about Denmark. And hopefully it's not unique to Denmark, but one of the things I noticed being just back in Denmark is not only have they got the virus under control, not only did they freeze the economy and not have anybody losing their jobs in any serious way and not have businesses going out of business, et cetera, not only are, you know, the cost of everything like rental cars and food just like it was 2 years ago last time I was there, but there's a general sense of optimism among the Danish people. And the Danes would not own up to that if you said, oh, Danes seem optimistic. Because, of course, they don't know. They don't know any more than we know. I mean, we know each other. They know each other. We don't know each other because we don't travel and they don't travel either. For the most part, most people don't travel, you know. So, you know, of course, what a Dane thinks about the rest of the world is going to be all relative, because they probably don't leave Denmark that much, just like most people don't leave most countries much. But the fact is, coming from a perspective of someone who's going to a lot of countries a lot, is there's a totally different atmosphere on the streets in Denmark and compared to here. There's not that sense of depression and anxiety and hopelessness that you find everywhere in this country over the past couple of years, especially several years, really. But in Denmark, there's a sense that there's a future. And, you know, I think that sense of a future existing has a lot to do with living in a society where people, and not only people, but the government, even elements of it, large elements of it, actually believe in the concept of society and care about society and make sure that society is able to continue to exist as such. You know, that's a pervasive thing in places like Denmark. And maybe that value isn't shared among the right wingers, but even on the right in places like Denmark, it's different than the right here. Like here, the right, here there's a widespread rejection of the welfare state, even among a lot of people who are not even don't even think of themselves as on the right.
Yeah, but in Denmark, in the rest of the world, they would be.
Right. In Denmark, everybody believes in the welfare state with almost no exceptions. And there's – so that's not a question. You know, and nobody believes in getting rid of universal health care. And that's not a question. So the right – what defines somebody on the right in Denmark is whether they're a xenophobe and whether they support U.S. imperialism. You know, the right-wingers in Denmark are xenophobes who support U.S. imperialism. But they don't believe that anybody in Denmark should be cut off of healthcare.
So Why did you book a return ticket?
I mean, to be honest, because I have a family here in.
No, no, I mean, I was just joking around. But
I mean, it's, you know, because it really, it's not. I mean, to me, it's not. It's not. I mean, I hate to say this to a comedian, but it's not. It's not even, you know, funny anymore. This country is such a disaster. I want to get out.
Have you thought? Well, I mean, you could. Have you thought about where would be a better place for your family? I mean, if I'm getting too personal, you don't have to answer.
No, it's okay. Yeah, I mean, because of the laws in terms of dual citizenship, I won't go into any details, but yeah, I'm looking into it.
All right, all right. Well, do you want to play a couple songs for us before we part ways here?
Sure.
Awesome. I'll let you play whatever you want, man. I'm just going to, once you're ready, I'm just going to go ahead and mute myself and let you take over.
Sure, I'm just getting some lyrics. I outsourced my brain to a device, you know, and okay, here we go. At least I remember my music most of the time, but the lyrics,
I feel ya.
Lincoln's bombing Baghdad, there's a famine in Tigray. Fires are burning in Flagstaff, blocking out the day. The wind blows so fiercely, the grass is turning brown. It's 116 degrees in Portland town. The spas and churches, dripping with blood. A tower collapsed in Miami, damaged from the flood. Before the summer's over, who knows how many will drown. It's 116 degrees in Portland town. The prices of houses are rising like never before, along with ocean waters as the temperatures soar. The developers develop, water tables go down. It's 116 degrees in Portland town. In the Congress, they're discussing infrastructure. Whether it should be built to withstand fire, they're not sure. They found a dead man in an RV wearing a thorny crown. It's 116 degrees in Portland town. Outside the motel, a man was flipping out. He called 911 to tell them about his need for mental health care, so they came and shot him down. It's 116 degrees in Portland town. In the farms in the valley, they're out picking cherries, dropping dead on the field with a bucket of berries. City of bridges, each one like a frown. It's 116 degrees in Portland town. Even north of the border, welcome to the new world order. Produced by criminal corporate clowns. It's 116 degrees in Portland town.
Man, you can strum that thing, my friend.
I've been working at it.
Some people in the chat were like, does he have three hands? What the hell is he doing?
I, the more depressed I get, the more I play the guitar. So it's really paying off.
You want to do one more?
Sure.
All right, do one more for us, man. Dealer's choice. And then after you're done with that, make sure you tell people where they can find this music.
Luckily, I mean, there's no money in this business anymore, but the music is easier than ever to find as long as they know my name.
It's true.
Just put my name in a search engine. But I'll do a given that today is Labor Day, I'll do a song related to Labor Day. Okay, this is Labor Day. For those who don't know, Labor Day was started in the United States after 1917, after the Russian Revolution, and after the Russian workers started celebrating the holiday that started in Chicago in 1886 called May Day, which is May 1st, International Workers Day, which is still celebrated around the world, everywhere except for the United States. And in the U.S., because we couldn't have International Workers' Day on the same day as other international workers, like the Russian ones, then we had to move it to September, which quite kind of kills the whole point. But I love May Day. I really dislike Labor Day. And I usually am in Denmark on May Day because May Day is like Christmas for left-wing musicians in places that celebrate it, because there's usually a labor union putting on an event in every town throughout the country. And the only problem is that it all happens on the same day. So like, I've never figured out how to do more than 5 gigs on May Day, because I start at 8 in the morning, end at 9 at night, and you can't actually fit in more than 5 gigs from my experience. But I haven't been there for 3 May Days in a row, and I missed it so much I had to write a song about how much I love May Day. Month of the year, on the 1st of May, known around the world as International Workers Day. You'll still see people marching in every corner of the earth, St. John to Santiago, Kerala to Perth, all keeping alive the fantasy, what could happen down the line, when the workers of the world combine. You can see us gathering early in the morn. Some are celebrating the shackles we have shorn, while so many billions are just waiting for the moment that we might stop losing the class war, when someday we can all say, yeah, we're doing fine, when the workers of the world combine. When that time arrives, maybe it looks like May Day, like a festival that comes home and doesn't go away. Every race and gender, every walk and station, with the working class united, every land and nation. Then just watch what happens when we follow the same sign, when the workers of the world combine. Fifth month of the year, on the 1st of May, known around the world as International Workers' Day.
That's awesome, man. David Rovics, everybody. David, let people know where they can find everything you got going on, where they can find those tunes and all your other stuff.
Oh, yeah, davidrovics.com. Look up the podcast This Week with David Rovics. Look for my music on Bandcamp and Spotify and SoundCloud and all those places. It's all there. Thank you.
Right on. Shout out to Richard Talk. Richard, hey, Ron, great show. Greetings from the UK. All the best, buddy. Thank you so much, Richard. And I hope all is well in the UK. And I can't wait to see you on the road. I will be there. And shout out to Kate. Kate, thank you so much for the Super Chat contribution. And Richard, thank you for the Rockfin tip. And Kate reminds everybody that Ron and Graham are going to be live San Francisco, Sacramento, and in Burbank/Los Angeles. September 11th, San Francisco. September 12th, Sacramento. And September 15th, Los Angeles. You can get all those tickets at romplacone.com. We had to cancel a lot of tour dates because of the pandemic, but some of the regional California stuff still happening. Come out. Good. Let's hang out. Let's make those few shows count. Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Richard. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Check out David's stuff, davidrovics.com. Grab those tickets, romplacone.com, San Francisco, Sacramento, Los Angeles. And
I'm going to England next month, too.
I'm so envious of you.
If they don't shut down the borders, I'm going there.
Man, I gotta, dude. Do you want? Do you have time to be my booking agent? Can you freaking? I feel like
we
you're.
We gotta talk.
We do have to talk. You're doing all the stuff I want to do. Like all the stuff I want to do, you do it. And
you need to play at the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh.
I know. I know. I've been wanting to do that for as long
I've
as
never
I mean
done
that was
it, but
one
that's
of,
where you need to be. I know that's where you need to be.
It's been one of my goals since day one, literally since like I was an open micer. I was like, someday I want to do the Fringe Festival. And I didn't know if I was going to ever get paid to do comedy. I had no idea if I'd ever do. I had no idea about anything. I just hoped that even if I was just doing 5 minutes at a pub in at 2 a.m. as like a guest, because I just saved up enough money to go. I was like, I want to do Edinburgh. And I still
if
haven't.
You people
freaking
are
done
watching
it
in Scotland. Offer write this man and offer him a free place to stay. That'll help.
That will help. And I and Edinburgh. Hey, Edinburgh has a special place in my heart. I got engaged there. So yeah, I proposed to I proposed to my wife in Edinburgh. So David, thank you so much, man. Always great catching up with you. Thanks so much for tuning in, guys. Especially on a pseudo holiday. I guess we'll call it a holiday. For those of us stateside. And thank you again, Richard. Thank you, Kate. Guys, grab those tickets. San Francisco, Sacramento, Los Angeles, romplicone.com. And you know the drill. Lucy says meow, and she's feeling much better. And David says peace. Yeah, she is a meowist. David says peace, and I say peace. We'll see y'all next time.